Observe how many of us there are who have our hopes fulfilled to the last detail. The number is uncountable. The greater our endeavors, the more we achieve, and so much the quicker will be our progression. Circumstances over which we have no control, to use a common phrase, may retard the fulfillment of our wishes, but there is much with which one can occupy one's self in the meantime. My own case will afford an example for you. When I first came to these lands and discovered the truth, I was troubled in mind by one book which I had written on earth, and which, unfortunately for me, could not now be unwritten. What was to be done? The thought came to me that if I might return to earth and speak the truth as I now knew it to be, I could counteract the unfairness and inaccuracies which I had set down, for the book dealt with this very subject of communicating with the spirit world. Help and advice were soon forthcoming, and from a source that, in my most sanguine moments, I could never have dreamed possible. But such is the way of the spirit world that help, earnestly sought, can and does come from the very highest sources. My request was granted, but there was one qualification. If I wished to communicate with the earth, I should have to wait for such time in the future when circumstances would allow of it. Various minor events would first have to take place in the lives of several people. In the intervening period, I could occupy myself variously to my own benefit. Here was a case where I had one eye, as you say, upon the future in a very specific way. At last came the day whereon I was able to break my silence. What was once a future event became very much a present event, and now it has receded into the past, where I regard it just as do you any event in your life. You have your red letter days, and so do we. This was one of mine. What of the interim period of waiting for my wish to be fulfilled, you may ask? My wise friends and advisers placed me in full possession of all the facts and circumstances. Although I never actually communicated with the earth before the moment of my new writing, yet I was conversant with all that was taking place among the different folk who would be, as it were, drawn into the accomplishment of my great desire. I was, therefore, aware of the passage of time on earth, and that events were steadily leading up to a focal point where I should be told, "Now you may speak." That will lead to a further question: how was it known that my wish would be fulfilled? You would say that it was a prophecy without a doubt. But whence did it come, and from whom? Now that, in good truth, is something that I have always wondered myself, and I am no nearer finding a conclusive answer. All that one can say at this juncture is that in the upper realms of the spirit world there live beings who are infinitely wiser than we are, and that their knowledge is correspondingly great. Their knowledge and wisdom combined will enable them to make an accurate prognosis based upon an accurate diagnosis. But this must not be regarded in any way as fatalistic predestination. As I view things now from my accumulated experience, I can see that there were many incidental happenings, contingencies, cross currents, as it were, that could have completely upset the plans and arrangements which were to culminate in my writing again. The ever-present and ever-to-be-respected free will of others was chief among them. But it so happened that at no time, nor upon any occasion, did the arrangements conflict with the wishes or sentiments of anyone, therefore that part of the scheme was concluded without hitch or setback. It was known, without the slightest doubt, that we should meet with no serious obstruction or other impediment upon the way which could not be successfully overcome. As soon as the chain of events began drawing to a close, I had a still clearer perception of all that was afoot that would lead to ultimate success. I called to mind the old terms of official sanction, nihil obstat, imprimatur. There was, however, one slight demur that we encountered, and that came from my earthly amanuensis. It was, in his opinion, a most unpropitious time in which to contemplate such a design. War had been let loose upon the world. People's minds were inevitably diverted to matters of a thoroughly material nature, and altogether, in his opinion, but not in ours, the outlook was gloomy and the chances of success problematical. We were soon able to dispose of that, however, because we were sure of our ground. Well, now, I have presented these details to you, I hope without tedium, to show that such prevision of the future as we are able to give on occasion, at least in such material matters as we have here discussed, is based upon a number of definite factors, and not upon some mysterious and very elusive condition of affairs, or upon the operation of a strange, complex, and incomprehensible law, whereby future events are set down in some book of chronological records, each awaiting inevitable fulfillment. Nor can we, in some abstruse way, project our minds into the infinity of time, choose some event from the collection of shadows of future occurrences, and then tell you all about it. Vague, incomplete, and unsatisfactory as this description is, yet it is by some folk deemed to be something of an attempted explanation of any foreknowledge of future happenings. What the whole truth is, I do not know, but I can tell you this. After leaving the Earth world, we do not instantly become endowed with profound knowledge, but we are able to exercise the powers of our minds, and we can sometimes see into the minds of Earth people. Upon the knowledge we have thus gleaned, we are able to declare that certain results will be observable upon a given situation, but without detailing the chain of events and circumstances which will eventually lead to those results. We could find an analogy, though an elementary one, in a particular service widely known upon Earth, and equally widely abused, namely, your weather forecasts. If you have a number of observers situated in different parts of the country, and who, at given times, are prepared to send reports of the weather conditions in their particular district and its surroundings to a central office, a sound idea of the prevailing weather of the whole country can be gained. Experts can then give a fairly correct forecast of future conditions. But if only one announcement were made during the period of 24 hours, much might have happened in the meantime of which you would be completely unaware, and which would falsify the whole forecast. For a certain tendency had been noted by the observers which, had it persisted, would have upheld the original forecast, but some new condition had set in. The wind, for example, blew from another direction, and so altered the entire meteorological prognosis. When you consider the mutability of men's minds, it is to be wondered at that certain trends, which we perceive in some persons' affairs, may be so influenced as to upset any mildly predictive statement that we may make. The truth is that few people on Earth are fully aware of the extent to which their material concerns are assisted and advanced by their unseen friends of the spirit world. We do our best to give what aid we can, without, at the same time, taking complete charge of your earthly lives, which would be wrong and is utterly forbidden. Furthering your affairs involves much work upon our part, where we must gently influence minds in your favor. As we see things progressing, we are able to give you some account of our efforts and their probable outcome. We say, in effect, that as things stand at this moment, all is moving favorably, and we have every hope of accomplishing our aims, whatever they may be, for your benefit. Then, before we have the opportunity to speak with you again, some incident, small in itself, but large in its consequences, may obtrude and wholly belie our previous words. Naturally you are disappointed, and perhaps a little distrustful of our utterances, though not necessarily of our intentions. It is obvious, you might say to yourself, that our unseen friends cannot do all they feel or wish they could do. Our prestige is apartment to drop somewhat, while the fault rests, in good truth, not with us, but with the changeable and sometimes uncertain mind of man. Perhaps it would be a wise precaution, when we come to discuss our earthly friends' affairs with them, if we added some proviso or another to protect ourselves in case of complete or partial failure. I am reminded of the time when I was incarnate. As a popular preacher, I covered a deal of ground, both literally and theologically, though of the latter the least said the better. In consequence, railway timetables were familiar to me. Now what would you think if upon every timetable you perceived some such notice as this, while every effort is made to see that all trains depart strictly on time? We cannot guarantee that any train will arrive on time or, indeed, that it will arrive at all, During the extremes of winter weather, the prompt arrival of trains may be a hazardous affair. That is something of which I need scarcely remind you. There is always that unhappy eventuality, an accident, which may prevent your arrival at your destination. Yet timetables in their way are a series of printed prophecies upon which, one has come to place a degree of reliance, without pausing to consider that a very small incident can falsify any of its statements. Men's minds can, indeed, bring the whole railway system to a stoppage, a situation not unheard of, you will agree. So you see that the outcome of any plans or arrangements into which you may enter with our help are beset with complications of one sort or another, any one of which might overthrow the whole, and compel a fresh start, perhaps from the very beginning. In giving you what we believe to be an ultimate result, we do so without admitting you to a knowledge of the train of events leading up to the conclusion. That is as well, since from overeagerness you might be tempted into precipitate action of your own and completely spoil matters. I am persuaded that beings in the highest realms are fully acquainted with all that lies before the individual as well as before the world in general. Perhaps you may think that spirit people might have something better to do than interest themselves so closely with terrestrial affairs. We have plenty to do, certainly. But what we do for the earth and its people is done in service and not because we lack employment, or because we are interfering busybodies. It is done because the earth world plays an important part in the universal scheme of life, and because, without the help of the spirit world, the earth would find itself in deep distress. Though the beings of those exalted realms know what lies in the future, that is not to say that the whole future is preordained, fixed, and immutable. And, as it were, irrevocably inscribed upon some gigantic cosmic chart or map. I believe the truth rests in the vast knowledge of every kind that these great personages possess, and that such knowledge can be passed down through a complete and unbroken chain of people until it reaches us in these lower realms. That is my opinion, and as such I give it to you. I am not just drawing upon my imagination for this, but basing it upon my own experiences of these wise souls, whose knowledge is simply prodigious, unbelievable. I have had demonstrations of it in affairs of my own, which I thought too insignificant to be worthy of their least attention. But I was completely wrong in thinking thus. When I first broached the question of communicating with the earth, the subject was referred to a higher authority. Since then, I have visited this very personage, in company with Edwin and Ruth, in his home in the highest realms. It is no exaggeration to say that we were amazed at the immense grasp he had of our simple affairs. We could not believe for one moment that he had merely been primed, as you would say, with full information concerning our three selves. While we know he is not possessed of all knowledge, yet we have ample evidence that his knowledge is enormous. Again it may be asked, why should an illustrious being, such as I describe him to be, show such knowledge of three people who are situated spiritually leagues from him? All I can say is that if we were the only three people so circumstanced, then it would be both remarkable and inexplicable, but most emphatically we are not. His knowledge is used for the benefit of the whole of these realms, and far beyond. And there is his wisdom as well. It is the application of both that we all of us experience here. I have chatted upon this subject with many friends and we are all convinced that from the great reservoir of knowledge and wisdom in these higher realms there comes the inspiration that is diffused throughout the spirit world, which in turn is transmitted to the earth world. For the scientist here will tell you that when he asks for guidance in his labors, that guidance comes in tangible form from some other realm. He knows not the direction whence it comes, all he knows is that come it does, without failure. The same thing applies to the engineer, or the musician, the painter, or the architect, and to all the numerous other departments of human endeavor. We may seem to have wandered far from our theme, the future, but in reality we have not, for I have been trying to probe things a little for you, to seek to discover whence or how any foreknowledge of the future can be derived. This we can be sure of, namely, that being endowed with free will, each one of us, without exception, Our various and respective paths are not laid down for us as though we were some locomotive engine confined to a permanent way from which we cannot deviate. That we have an ultimate destiny, there is no possible doubt, namely, that we should so progress spiritually that at last we shall attain to the highest heaven and so to the greatest happiness. But we shall each of us reach that great altitude by a myriad different ways. Our course is more easily perceived when we become residents of the spirit world. While we are incarnate, our vision is limited, very limited, but we can always claim the right to exercise our free will, and none has the right to prevent us. It is true that with an individual's cooperation we may suggest and map out a certain road for him, whereon to travel his earthly journey, and we may do all we can to further that aim. But should the object of our interest or endeavors express his disapproval and wish to go upon his own way, it is forbidden that we should do otherwise than allow him to make his choice and exercise his free will. You must know that after we have passed from earth into these beautiful realms of the spirit world, we have undergone an experience which yet awaits you, and we are that much the better informed. We have advanced a little further along the road than have you, and we are upon rising ground where our vision is less restricted and our outlook is wider, more comprehensive, and where we can draw in full measure upon the many wise minds who dwell here. It is completely wrong to attach so much importance to predictive utterances, as though the whole subject and practice of communication between the spirit world and the earth world depended upon them. There are many empty minds upon earth who fondly believe that if they were given a correct forecast of the result of some sporting event, they have thereby proved that there is such a place as a spirit world, and that there are such things, as they call us, as spirit people. They fancy they have achieved something, when in reality they have proved nothing beyond their own stupidity, which was never in question. What of their departed relatives and friends? Are they to be regarded as living only among the great ones of the highest heaven? Perhaps in their presumption they imagine so. Would they deem the accurate forecast of sporting results as sufficient to establish the identity and bona fides of their cherished friends who have passed on before them? Dear me, no. That would never do. That sort of thing is preposterous. Their relatives would not communicate. All of which is remarkably silly, my dear friends. We are not here in the spirit world especially to think for you nor to place certain people with trivial minds in possession of information which would give them a material advantage over their neighbors. It is only necessary to answer such fools according to their folly. We are no soothsayers, but we are anxious to help our friends on earth to surmount the many difficulties incidental to their earthly lives, to smooth the way a little. And that is all part of the grand scheme for our spiritual progression. One, the problem here is that the Monsignor is not yet in the eternal realms and is indeed still in a time-space realm. He is not yet aware of that, and that is not uncommon. For more information I suggest reading The Gate of Heaven by Robert James Lees or The Paget Messages. Two, on rare occasions the future may be shared with us. This is the source of premonitions and dreams that prove to be amazingly accurate. All such information emanates from Father, often specifically from our indwelling spirit. Spirits are often asked about the future, and some lower-level spirits may enjoy fortune-telling. They may be able to make an accurate prediction based on their vastly greater sources of information, but no spirit actually knows the future. Next headline is, Color. About halfway along a passage upon the upper floor of our house there is a small bay in which a brief flight of stairs leads to a door. Through this door I have taken many friends, especially new arrivals in spirit lands, for this door opens directly upon a section of flat roof. From here a magnificent view is to be gained of a great tract of the countryside, with the city gleaming in the distance. To those who have not as yet travelled through these realms, or at least this small segment of them, the view from the roof comes as something of an inspiring revelation to them. With scarcely an exception, we receive the same reply to a question which one or other of us delights in putting to our new visitor, namely, what strikes you most forcibly as you gaze upon this scene? The answer, the riot of color. Most assuredly, that is so. It is a sight which never fails. To fill us with fresh wonder and charm, seasoned residents though we be, the reason is to be found not only in the delight to the physical sense of sight, but what is more important in many ways, the color itself is exhilarating. This feeling of exhilaration is not some doubtful spiritual experience, intangible and apartment to evaporate after a brief while. It is much more than that. It rejuvenates one, even in these realms of juvenility. It braces one up, as you would say, and acts like a tonic. The contrast between our world and yours in this matter of color alone is tremendous. The two worlds are not to be compared. Indeed, what the earth lacks and needs most urgently in some quarters, is color, a vast deal more color. Your towns are drab, dreary, and toneless. Perhaps I shall be taken to task for that statement, but you must remember that I once lived upon earth, and that I am now living in the spirit world. My statement is a comparative one. Were you to have even the most fleeting glimpse of these realms, you would at once be convinced. Bethink you of the dingy state of your buildings. You will, of course, appreciate that I am speaking of normal times on earth and not of now, after all the horrors of war have left their grim marks, and the years of enforced neglect have added to the murkiness. When your buildings are first erected, they stand in their pristine freshness, and they are more or less tolerable because they are clean, and free from the grime which is bound in time to envelop them. Some folk will admire the dark greyness of the ancient buildings, such as the great Gothic cathedrals. They will say that time has mellowed the newness of the stone, and added beauty and grandeur to the masterpieces of olden days. As an expressed opinion, one is bound to respect it, but I can say this: wait until you see one of our buildings and the force of my remarks will make itself manifest. You would instantly exclaim how glad you are to know that no grime and dirt can come, no structural dilapidations, to spoil the eternal beauty of our masterpieces of architecture or of even the simplest and most unpretentious cottage. It is true, of course, that you have such a condition of affairs on earth as we could not have here. The smoke of the towns and cities, for example, which quickly makes the buildings dull and dirty. But the time will come when smoke will no longer be present to constitute the menace it is at present. Other methods will be devised, and the smoke will vanish and never to reappear. At least that would ensure that your towns are clean as far as its buildings are concerned. But the color will still be missing if nothing is done about it. The tendency through the passage of years on earth has been towards less and less color, and nowhere is this more noticeable than in the very clothes you wear. There was a time on earth when folk wore the gayest and brightest colors. This was not left to the women folk alone, for the men were equally gaily habited. If people on earth knew the real value and influence of color upon the mind, and thence upon the body, which would in turn react upon a whole nation, they would be literally astonished. You will understand that I am not advocating some new essay in dress reform, though there is ample room for that too. The men are the worst offenders, for their clothes are drab and uninspiring from the color point of view. I am persuaded that the most dismal and lugubrious experience is to stand before an audience or congregation of clergymen, all attired in their clerical black. That is how it seems to me now. Nothing could be more funereal and suggestive of everything that is melancholy and depressing. Certainly some of the clergy have become a little bolder since my days on earth, and with great daring have clothed themselves in sober, very sober, and grey. At least that is a turn in the right direction, but religion should be happy and cheerful, and the ministers of it should be attired so as to proclaim that fact. So much that is associated with religion is clothed in black. Never was the deterioration in the use of color on earth more noticeable than in the spirit world. For when people arrive here and wear the clothes to which they were accustomed when incarnate, they look utterly incongruous because their clothes are colorless. Usually it is not long before they change to their new mode of dress. That is a matter we do not press upon our newly arrived friends. But the instant they feel out of place in their old earthly habiliments, the change takes place. There are exceptions, though very few. I recall when my former ecclesiastical superior, a prince of the church, came to reside here. Following the usual custom, he wore his earthly clothes, by which you will understand that I mean their counterpart. As they were already rich and colorful, they looked splendid in these surroundings, so much so that he was persuaded not to discard them just yet. And, of course, he felt perfectly comfortable so attired. Wherever he went, people who did not know him personally or by repute knew him for what he had been on earth. Eventually, however, he donned his spirit attire, which was equally colorful and gracious to the eye. In the spirit world, color plays a vital part in our lives, for it provides us not only with visual enjoyment, but from color come musical sounds of surpassing beauty and purity. It also contributes towards the life-giving force from which we derive our very existence. After spending so many years on earth attired in black, our clergymen friends of these and other realms are delighted when they can at last put it off for the natural brightness of their own spirit clothes. So many of the religious denominations on earth have shunned any approach to color, beyond stained glass windows, by abolishing the use of vestments which were at least pleasant to the eye. One church, however, has retained them fully. Though their liturgical colors may be emblematical, yet they serve a useful purpose by adding brightness and color to the proceedings, whatever the true value of the latter may be. Black makes its persistent appearance in the services for the dead, to give solemnity to observances which cannot be otherwise than awe-inspiring, for what could be more awful than death? So it is thought. One could think of something far worse than death itself, and that is the special kind of heaven conjured up in the minds of some folk that is supposed to follow that death. Black has come to be associated with the various trappings of dissolution, although once upon a time on earth the color for mourning was not black but yellow. It is remarkable that some people once favored this particular color, for yellow is most decidedly a soothing color for the incarnate if properly used, so that in days past when people like their brethren today were in sore distress at the loss of a dear one, for human affections have always persisted, the use of yellow attire will have exerted a calming and comforting influence upon them. There is everything to commend the use of this bright, cheerful color in such circumstances. It would be far better had it never been displaced by black. Color upon earth presents a wide field for investigation, for its potentialities are scarcely known. It can be made to exert a most beneficial influence upon the health and temperament of the incarnate if it is rightly employed. Here in the spirit world, color is utilized particularly to bring back stability into troubled minds and in the treatment of folk whose passage into these lands has been violent or otherwise distressing. When I saw a rest home for the first time, I observed a shaft of blue light was descending upon and enveloping the whole edifice. This, I was told, would provide all that was necessary for initial treatment. There are rays of many colors to be seen descending upon the homes of rest, each for its special purpose. It is not only the color which produces the required results, but the elements of the ray itself. Indeed, the color here plays a relatively minor part, though when the ray is actually perceived, the pleasant nature of the color will bring a large measure of joy to the beholder. When you come to consider the wide diversity of transitions and their causes, each calling for special treatment and care in the rest homes and elsewhere, you will see the need for the range of colors in the rays to be equally diverse. But as there is no end, or seemingly there is none, to the number of tints and blends which can be derived, you will see that ample provision is made for every type of transition. These rays are wonderful to view in operation, for the colors and their myriad blends are truly thrilling. There is no other word to describe them. You must understand they are not mere colored light. The shades of blue, for instance, I have seen them from the very darkest and richest to the palest and most delicate, and of such a nature that even the former was brilliant and bright, though darker than the deepest sapphire. You could not simulate this one color on earth without reducing very greatly the illuminating power and extent of the light. In the same way, you could not evolve the pale blue without losing brilliance and intensity of the color. Excepting the light of the sun, of course, your light is otherwise artificial, while ours is real and full with life. One could say that your light is dead, or rather, lifeless, while ours is living light.